Welcome to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you with us today as we have two great guests for you. One is Kevin Schesso, the Ag Development Educator for UW-Madison Division of Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. Kevin, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Oh, as always, Larry, it's a pleasure, and it's good to do this as a team. So, and we're on this Google Meet, so we can see each other. One of the great outcomes of the pandemic, right?
Exactly. And Diana Alfeth is the other member of the team. Diana, the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. Diana, good to see you.
Great to be here again, Larry. It's always fun.
Well, I tell you what, we're going to have fun today because we're going to be talking about different kinds of mulches. We'll also take a look at getting the most from your tomato plants and your other vine crops, and certainly answer questions relating to vegetables. We could do flowers and other things as well, certainly. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. And let's start with mulch. I guess there are some good reasons to have mulch in your garden to apply to the soil, Diana.
Right. Mulches are really, really beneficial in a lot of different ways. And it doesn't matter what garden you're talking about, if it's a flower garden, if it's perennials, annuals, shrubs, trees, or a vegetable garden, there's a mulch for every application. So mulches, we've had a lot of drought conditions across the state, which have kind of eased a little bit this last week, but mulches help to conserve moisture so that it doesn't evaporate out of the soil as fast. It helps to keep the soil cooler. And my favorite, it keeps weeds down because nobody likes being out there, especially in this heat, pulling weeds, right? So like in a flower bed, a perennial bed or a shrub bed, if you put down 4 inches of like shredded wood mulch and then, it'll decompose. So you have to top it off every couple years or so. That will smother out most of the weed seeds. And any weeds that do grow on top of that mulch are really easy to pull out. So I think to me, that's the biggest benefit. It also obviously makes things look nice. In the vegetable garden, we have a demonstration garden up here in River Falls that a bunch of master gardeners helped me with. And we always put down like cardboard and then straw over the top of it. And then we don't have hardly any weeding to do in the vegetable garden all year. So mulches are fabulous things. And there are lots of different products that you can use. So whatever you have available or you can get your hands on can do the job for you.
Yeah, so organic. What about inorganic mulches?
Well,
And Kevin, let's go to you for that.
Sure. And I echo everything Diana said. And you know me, Larry, I'm the soils guy, and I'm always saying, add more, till less. So add more organic matter. So these organic mulches that Diana already referenced fits right in with that mantra. But I understand that, not everybody wants to put organic mulch down, or they have maybe have access, where do you find this stuff? So there is a place for non-organic mulches, but I'm always encouraging people to think, the pros and cons of everything we do, and especially gardening. It's no one size fits all, shades of green, as we say, but the inorganic mulches, the plastics, the fabrics, I wouldn't include stone and pea gravel in, that's somewhere in between, because give it enough time, it'll break down. But those are really not going to add anything back to the soil. And now you have to worry about what happens to that material over time. Unfortunately, a lot of our landscape fabrics that are very common, and they're a quick fix. It's convenient. It's just like a lot of things in life these days. We want the simple, easy answer. Quick and convenient. Yeah, you roll down that synthetic plastic or weave. You got a weed barrier for how long? It's just a matter of time before weeds will penetrate some of that There are some fabrics that are that will allow water to penetrate through the fabric and are pretty good at keeping weeds out. They're more of a spun type fabric than the open weave, like, you know, fabric woven. Those invariably, roots have no problem breaking through that. So I just encourage people to think why those are inorganic fabrics might be more suitable. Certainly they work for a lot of other reasons, stabilizing the soil and erosion control and this and that. And there are different types of fabrics that will do that are sort of inorganic or based off of wood chips and woven in there to be a little more sustainable, if you will. But, you know, again, at some point that barrier is going to fail and now you got to deal with it. So I'm really trying to convince people to think about changing their habits and going organic or non-organic, I guess.
One thing to keep in mind, if you use a black plastic or a landscape fabric in your vegetable garden, and then you peel it up at the end of the year, that can have some good merit. You do have to be careful because they're black, and if that absorbs the sun, that can really heat up the soil, and you can cause some heat stress issues, which certainly would have been a issue this year with the heat that we've had. But if you're doing a perennial bed or a shrub border, never, ever, ever put a landscape fabric or plastic underneath organic mulch. So never under your wood chip or shredded wood mulch should there be that fabric, because what happens is that wood mulch will decompose, and now it's decomposing on top of that fabric, and that's a great little compost layer for seeds to germinate. So like Kevin said, it may look great for a year or two because it does block the seeds that are underneath it in the soil from germinating, but then you're going to have weeds growing on top of that fabric. So that fabric isn't doing you any good at all after a couple of years. And the weeds poke their roots right through that. And then you have a big mess and you have to peel it all up and it breaks apart and you have shredded plastic in your landscape forever. And so that stuff is important if you're using a rock mulch, which we could talk about too. Rock mulch has its place, but it's usually not the best option because of the heat that it gives off. It kind of creates stress for plants. So an organic mulch like wood chips or shredded wood is great, but put it right on the soil. Don't put any of those barriers underneath it because you will regret it later.
I did that once many years ago, and you're right. I did regret it very much trying to pull that up, a few years after the fact. It was a huge mess. That was a long, long time ago. That was a lesson learned and never repeated that again. I can tell you that for free. Well, Mary in Madison has a mulch question. Let's go there. Hi, Mary.
Good morning. I see a lot of trees being mulched with bark mulch. It's kind of popular now. But a lot of the time the mulch goes right up to the bark, and so it's right where the moisture can cause rot and so forth with the bark. And this is done even with mature trees that you would like to see them live for a long time. So, you can go to any website and it tells you how to do it, but people don't seem to know how to do it. And then even major landscaping companies I've seen doing that. So do you have anything you can say about that?
Yeah, you can drive around Madison, for example, and you can see the mulches that probably were put in by companies that should know better, that are the mulches right up against the trees. Diana.
And don't you want to just stop and go pull it away? I mean, yes. Run into that yard. So you're absolutely right. If you pile mulch up against the bark, the trunk of the tree, it can cause rotting in there. It can girdle the tree. So you got to think donut, not volcano. Okay. So that bark should start about an inch, or that wood mulch should start about an inch away from the trunk at the soil level, and then be mounded up like a big donut or inner tube around that tree, but not up against the actual trunk of the tree. So you're absolutely right. We see this problem a lot. It can damage and even kill your tree. So it is a serious thing. And like I said, think donut, not volcano.
Thanks, Mary. Kevin in Madison, your turn. Hi, Kevin.
Thank you. What is the best material to mulch with up against the house foundation? Either a concrete part of a foundation, or like for a walkout, it might be the wood sheathing with just some siding, or maybe there's foam insulation in there, but you know, that would not be concrete if it's like a walkout where the kind of the sheathing goes all the way down to the ground level. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like if I want to put some shrubs in or some hostas or something, and I want to mulch around there, right around the foundation, either that or where the concrete is exposed from the basement. I'm wondering what the best mulch material to use would be.
Okay, let's see who wants to take that one. Kevin, you want to start?
Well, I can certainly try talk Kevin to Kevin here. and I think Diana too would echo this. You know, it's again, whenever we're doing landscaping, we have to think about the plan and the right plant in the right place, and understanding the environment, and you know, shade versus full sun and soil type. And now you've got a unique environment once you get into the foundation plantings. And, you know, what you described is, you know, certainly, you know, a question that I'm sure a lot of people who understand that interface, and now how do we manage that zone that's pretty unique, because obviously you don't want to have any kind of moisture damage or problem with the foundation, you know. So the first thing we need to at least acknowledge is that we want to make sure water is draining away from the foundation before we, you know, or if we are like renovating or doing some kind of landscaping, is just keep an eye on that slope of the soil and the bed, so that we're encouraging water to drain away. And that's where the downspouts and all that stuff can come into play too. So that would be like just one of those big picture considerations. And then after that, you know, it kind of gets back to, you know, what look do you want? Is there an issue with, you know, drainage that you might want to increase or decrease? And some of the mulches, you know, rock is probably, like Diana said, it has its place. And in certain areas, maybe it's more appropriate. But without, you know, doing that overall planning of, you know, which mulches would be best, I'm still going to advocate that, you know, if you have access, a lot of this is, where do you find the mulch and how much do you need and what's it going to cost and what look do you want? You know, so that's all gets back to those personal preferences and what are the plants going to do, you know, in that environment. So I don't know, Diana, if there's any specific mulch types that work better with shrubs versus, you know, perennial plants, herbaceous kind of plants.
Yeah, I would agree with what you said. One of the biggest concerns when you're getting up against the foundation is moisture. So if it's up against concrete, it's usually not that big of a deal. But if your siding goes right down to the ground, you don't want to pile mulch up against the siding, especially if it's some kind of wood siding, because that would hold moisture and that might cause that siding to rot. So similar to what we just talked about with the last caller, if you just like keep it an inch away from that foundation, and then it piles up to 4 inches deep over the bed area, you should be okay with that, as long as, like Kevin mentioned, the underlying soil has the proper slope away from the foundation. Once you get into that, rock mulch, like I said, it has its place, and that's usually where there's a steeper slope and you might have some erosion that would wash wood mulch away. But that's about the only time I'm going to recommend rock mulch, because while people think that it's lower maintenance because you don't have to top dress it with more wood mulch every couple of years, it actually becomes higher maintenance, because that's where you do need that fabric underlaying, because the rock doesn't keep the weeds down. You need to put down that landscape fabric and then you put the rocks on top. But over a few years, you have dust and leaves and dirt that falls on those rocks and then piles on top of the landscape fabric under there, and then you get weeds growing in the rocks, and that's an even bigger backbreaking mess to fix up than anything. So I always go back to shredded wood being the best. I like it better than chips, because chips blow around because they are individual chunks, whereas shredded wood kind of tangles itself together and kind of forms a mat. And if you put that 3 to 4 inches deep and then top it off every couple of years, you're going to have very few weeds. You'll be getting the moisture control. It looks nice. Now, there are dyed wood mulch out there that'll be like bright gold or bright red or that sort of a thing. There are questions about that dye. It usually fades out in a year or two anyway. If you really like that look, go ahead. My personal opinion is the flowers and plants should be grabbing your attention, not the bright color of the mulch, but that's a personal preference. So I think you'd be just fine using a shredded wood mulch around the foundation. Again, rock absorbs heat. So if you've got the wall of your house and the rock absorbing heat, like on a south or west side, you're going to have a highly stressful place for plants. Sometimes people say that wood mulch around the foundation might encourage ants or things like that to get into the house. That might happen. And, you know, if you get an issue with some insect in that wood, you know, you can treat for that. But I just don't think that's as common as it's made out to be. So that would be my opinion. Shredded wood mulch in your foundation planting.
Diana Alfeth and Kevin Shesso, our guests today on Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller. Lee Rayburn, our engineer. Jill Nadeau, our producer. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. You know, we're partnering with UW-Madison's Extension Horticulture Program to learn more about your experience listening to Garden Talk. We'd love to find out what you learned during the show and how you'll put it to good use, as well as get your ideas for future Garden Talk topics. And it's easy to do. Just go to WPR.org/Larry. It's WPR.org/Larry. Click on today's show for a link. Or you can type in GoWisconsin.edu/radio to any browser. It'll just take a couple of minutes to do it, to fill out the form. So we hope you'll do that at some point during the show. Love to have you participate in that. Kevin Shesso and Diana Alfeth, our guests today. We have many callers online, so let's go to Marty in Duluth, Minnesota. Marty, hi.
Hi, good morning. About 2 weeks ago, I put a bunch of herbs into a south-facing bed. They get water, they get food, they went into good soil. I talked to them. They are not happy. Nobody's growing. Nothing has gotten any bigger in this 2 weeks than it was when I put it in.
Hmm.
And I know that has nothing to do with mulch, but maybe it has everything to do with mulch. Who knows?
Okay. Well, what say you, Kevin?
Well, again, it's where we have to kind of say, you know, put our CSI hats on, or our crime scene investigation for horticulture, and do a little more thinking about, you know, what may be causing some of this stunted growth or lack of vigor. And, you know, we can start with, you know, the soil, and you mentioned that it may be, you know, I don't know if you have a soil test or not, but we want to start with the soil. And if you think everything's going good there as far as, you know, you've been adding amendments and there's adequate fertility that should be there. And if you've grown plants there in the past that did well, then, you know, okay, we're assuming the soil maybe isn't the issue. You know, then you get to, you know, other environmental stuff or how were the plants when you planted them. I'm thinking, you know, were they root bound? Were they under stress? And they're still coming out of that. You know, with the weather, you know, maybe that set them back, and they're just still waiting to really get happy in their new home. Because sometimes those transplants, and I don't know if these were with seeds or were they transplants?
Marty, were they seed or transplant?
Transplant.
Transplants. Okay. Okay.
Yeah, right. So that gets back to, and I don't know what, you know, what the root ball looked like when you transplanted them, but, you know, I always encourage people, you know, to either tickle the roots and, you know, open that root ball up a little bit, or in some cases, if it's really root bound, I'm not afraid to go in there with a little knife or spread those roots apart with my fingers before I plant it, just to encourage those roots to explore more soil instead of keep, you know, circling around. So, you know, maybe there was some stress from being, you know, transplanted and potted. And then, you know, if you're not seeing any other diseases, or, you know, if the leaves aren't yellowing, you know, they otherwise look healthy and they're just kind of just sitting there waiting, I'm just wondering if they're just not quite exploring that new soil and you know, getting new growth to happen, because they're just not getting the nutrients and water to do that just yet.
Yeah. Diana was nodding her head yes too. So.
Yeah, I think 2 weeks, they're probably growing some roots underground and not worrying about putting top growth on. So as long as they look good, as long as they have enough moisture, but don't overwater them, because remember, roots need oxygen. I think you just got to wait a little bit more and they'll start taking off.
All right. Good luck. Thank you, Marty. Esty in Madison, your turn. Hi. Thanks for calling.
Yeah. Hi. Thank you. Actually, my question relates to the one from Kevin a couple calls ago. I have a foundation where water has come into the basement and, you know, caused flooding and mold. And so I actually paid a landscaper to create the slope and all that. At the same time, I discovered that the snow on the mountain plants that I thought were nice at first, I don't know how they came, but they planted themselves. And I realized that they were really invasive and taking over. So I started pulling them away, discovering that the root systems were really deep and complex, and kept pulling them away. And then at some point I started thinking that maybe I should let them be, because with that root system, they will protect that slope from erosion and will just keep it in good shape. And I'm not sure how to think about that. I wonder what your thoughts are.
Diana, what do you think?
So snow on the mountain, also called gout weed and a bunch of other names, it comes in the variegated green and cream leaves. It comes in solid green. And you're right, it is kind of attractive, and it forms a great ground cover. It's also pretty aggressively invasive, as you found, where it spreads. But if it's in a confined area, it's fine to leave it there. And if you do have a slope, you're right, you don't want that to be bare soil, because if you get a 3-inch thunderstorm, you're going to have erosion. So if you're okay with it, if you kind of like the look of it, if you can kind of keep it in a confined area so that it doesn't just keep going out and out and out, because it'll, you know, continue to spread as much as it wants to, it kind of has its place. Now, I don't know, Kevin, maybe you know offhand if it's officially on the state's NR40 invasive species list. I kind of don't think it is. If it is, it's not prohibited. It would be restricted. But sometimes we see it planted in an area that's, you know, bordered by cement on all sides, so it can't go any further. And it's fine. I don't really think it spreads by seed. It just spreads by roots. So if you can stop those roots or keep whacking it back to keep it in bounds, lots of people have it. Lots of people like it. And it might be a good plant for that spot if you have an erosion issue. So it's kind of... Mm-hmm.
Okay.
How can I confine it? It's not at all confined, and it was going into my the other parts of my yard where I don't need something like that.
Right. And you can put in edging if you do, you know, like the black landscape edging, the deep stuff that's at least 6 inches deep, and you put that around the area. That'll stop most of the roots from being able to jump that. Make sure that you put that edging down all the way so that that bulb is like a half an inch buried. You want to see the top of the top half of that circular bulb at the top, but you're trying to stop those underground roots from spreading. So make sure that you use the deep edging. There are also some kinds of edging available that don't have that bulb that are just a straight thing. That can hold back most of it. You'll still get the occasional one that either crawls its way over or under that edging. But then you can just, you know, pull that out, dig it out maybe, and try to keep it back that way. Herbicides can also work on it where you can zap those. They're most effective in the fall. That stuff is pretty tenacious because, as you know, it has a big root system. So the herbicides aren't a quick, easy fix. Usually it takes more than one zapping of it. But some edging to create a barrier for those roots might help you out.
Good luck. Thank you. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Kevin.
Well, I was just going to quick comment that, you know, I did quick look up on the DNR's invasive plants website, and Bishop's goatweed or snow on the mountain is on their kind of nasty or naughty list. and it is classified as a restricted invasive plant because of the things that you already talked about. With a lot of our invasive plants, they're just, you know, a little more aggressive than we like to see, and especially when they get in natural areas. But it is ubiquitous. It's found all over the state. And they call it restricted, just meaning that, yeah, it's here. We don't want to encourage more of it. So if you have it, understand that and manage it accordingly. And, you know, certainly don't go out of your way to be spreading it, especially into natural areas.
There we go. Thanks again for calling. Appreciate it. Mary in Superior emailed to ask what she can safely use on a basil plant for whatever is eating little holes in the plant leaves.
Yeah, well, this is a tough one because, you know, we eat the leaves, right? This is an edible, you know, plant that we want to go out there and snip the leaves off of and, you know, wash it, of course, and then have it in our meals, right? So whenever we see plant damage, we really got to contemplate what are our options to do that safely because, you know, we're going to consume it at some point, right? That's the whole point. And that's the part, you know, the whole plant you can eat technically. So I would really be reluctant to do any kind of a spray on this. And again, CSI here, is it an insect chewing mouth parts? You know, well, then where's that insect hiding? Sometimes they might be in the soil and they crawl up at night. You know, so you can maybe investigate around the plant and dig up something that, that might be causing the problems. You know, I guess it's just a matter of how severe it is, but I'm really going to be cautious about spraying. There are some organic type products, the BT sprays, the Bacillus thuringiensis, that you know, work on certain caterpillar type insects that might work. Insecticidal soaps, I'd be okay with that, but you know, we really got to figure out what's causing the issue, and that sometimes requires a little more detective work before we can come up with a recommendation. Yeah, it's a tough one. Nobody likes to see their food disappear in front of them.
Yeah, and we don't have a picture or anything, but it mentions small little holes. So not a lot of things eat herbs. They're usually pretty left alone by things. But I'm going to guess, Kevin, maybe you'll agree, flea beetles, because flea beetles are having a really good year, and they chew tiny little round holes in all kinds of leafy things. And the reason that you get to that basil plant, you don't actually see the insect, is flea beetles are tiny. They're about the size of a sesame seed, and they're shiny black, but they jump as soon as they're disturbed, like a flea. And so as soon as you walk up to that plant, boom, they're gone. So you don't actually see them there. But like Kevin said, before we can actually treat anything, we need to identify what it is. Assuming it's flea beetles or something else that you can't see, my recommendation for an herb plant would be floating row covers, because floating row covers are spun polyester, kind of like bridal veil fabric. And you just drape them over the plants, anchor them down, and then anything that's flying in can't access the plants, so the damage will stop. If it's something crawling up from the soil, like a cutworm or whatever, obviously it's not going to help with that. But most everything is flying in these days at this time of the year. And if it's a plant that does not need pollination, covering these plants with row covers is your easiest, most organic way to control the damage. And that's a good thing for things like cabbages and broccoli and cauliflower. When you get those little green worms on it, those are the larvae of those little white and yellow butterflies that lay their eggs on those plants. So if you can put a row cover over that so the butterflies can't access the plants, they can't lay their eggs on it. And that's the same thing with flea beetles, which will also affect beans and spinach and lettuce and all kinds of other things. So invest in some row covers. They are the greatest organic control for a vegetable garden.
Mary, thanks for that email. David in Wenshaw, Minnesota, emailed to say he uses grass clippings cut after the dandelion seeds have blown away. Works great in the vegetable garden, but do the grass clippings add any nitrogen to the soil? They'll add a little, won't they?
Yeah, no. I mean, you know, again, you just think about how nature recycles nutrients. You know, nature does just fine without our help, give it a chance, right? So all that vegetation eventually decomposes and will be recycled back into the soil. So, yes, there is going to be some nutrient benefit from that over time. The challenge with, you know, all of these materials is it takes a while before those nutrients are available to the plant. So it might not be an immediate response, but you'll certainly see the benefit. And as the microbes begin to chew on all that, and then earthworms incorporating it or fungus attacking it, you know, all of that starts to, you know, that interface between the mulch surface and the soil. You know, the only caution I have, and it doesn't sound like, you know, if it's your own sourced grass clippings, you know what's been put on that lawn. You know where it came from. You know the quality of it. That's the case with all of these sourced mulches, is you just have to be aware that, all right, was there any herbicide put on that grass? Because we know, and I know, Diana, you've had these calls too, where, you know, somebody gets grass clippings, they want to do the right thing and mulch around their tomato plants. And guess what? It came from a lawn service that, you know, the client wanted their grass clippings removed, so they put them into the big, you know, container. And now what do you do with these clippings? Oh, I'll take them. I'll use them in my garden. Well, if they come from a treated grass, there could be residue from usually a broadleaf herbicide, and that will still be on those leaves, the grass clippings, and they can leach into the soil, and they can cause herbicide damage to your tomatoes in this case. So that would be my only caution with grass clippings, and certainly being aware of the weeds that might be in there, the weed seeds, you know, if you can minimize that, like he said, collecting them, you know, after the weed seeds have gone to, you know, seed, and there's less chance of moving that stuff around. But I think it's better to use the grass clippings than not, but just be aware of the source.
And the other thing is, if you put them on when they're fresh and green, a lot of times they kind of mat down and mold, and they kind of get a little slimy and yucky. So if there's a way for you to collect the grass clippings, maybe spread them out on the driveway for a day or two to dry out a little bit, then it's like mini straw. And then you don't get that molding issue as much. So that's a consideration as well.
Let's go to Scott in Duluth, Minnesota next. Scott, hi.
Good morning. Boy, your subject is really timely for me. I really appreciate it. I am in the process of putting in a rock bed that's going to slope away from the house under a deck. We renovated about 10 years ago, added a deck, and have kind of tried in vain to grow grass under the deck, and we've been only partially successful. And really not successful at all, closer to the house and where it's more shaded. and therefore the dirt that's just kind of around our mini split air conditioner unit splashes up on the mini split air conditioning units and gets them dirty, and we've got to do something else. So my project that I've got going right now, I put edgers down. They're like pavers. They're bricks around the perimeter, and I've put down some topsoil to slope away from the house. I have a couple questions for you about that fabric, the laying down of landscaping fabric stage. And number one, it rained a little bit a night or two ago, and it's a little bit moist, so should I let that fully dry out before I do that? Number two, I've got a little bit of grass stubble growing on part of it. Should I be really compulsive about, you know, trying to get all that out of there or just laying the fabric down? Can I do that? And then it'll die off. Number three, most importantly, what choice of fabric material is best? Just plain plastic or the more porous kind? There's one that almost has a cloth-like look. That looks like it's almost like a hard, tough paper product. Thanks.
Okay. Well, Diana, go ahead.
Yeah. So first off, I think you should use the heaviest duty. This is a situation where rock mulch is good. You can't really grow good grass under a deck because it's too shady. And depending on how the deck is built, it may or may not let water drip through to water down there. So this is a place where a rock mulch might be a good option. I would use the heaviest duty landscape fabric that you can get rather than a plastic. It's just going to likely last longer down there. That stuff is made for water to infiltrate it, so you don't have to really worry about letting it dry out first, because theoretically the it's made for water to go through it, okay? Because you could plant in there as well. So even though you can't grow grass down there, you can grow hostas and other shade-loving plants. And so you don't have to just look at bare rock mulch anymore. You could also use, you know, an organic mulch like we were talking about earlier down there. It doesn't have to be rock. But so I would use the heaviest duty landscape fabric versus a plastic. You don't have to let it dry out. And the grass that's under there, I would try to get that out of there before you lay it down, because some grass has such good root systems. I have seen quack grass grow up through blacktop. And so it'll find its way sometimes through that landscape fabric, and then it's growing up in through your mulch. And so if at all possible, it's really best to have a totally clean slate before you lay that down.
All right. There we go. Thank you so much for that question, Scott. Appreciate it very much. Kevin Chesso is the Ag Development Educator for UW-Madison's Division of Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties. Diana Alfeth, the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Just a reminder, we're partnering with UW-Madison Extension Horticulture Program to learn more about your experiences listening to Garden Talk. I'd love to find out what you learned during the show and how you put it to use, and maybe some ideas from you for future Garden Talk topics. Just go to WPR.org/Larry. Click on today's show note for a link. And that's probably the easiest way to do it. It'll just take you a couple of minutes to fill out that form. Let's take some more calls here. Faith in Waupun, your turn. Hi, Faith.
For a link, and that's probably the easiest
way. Oh, Faith has got her radio turned up. Faith, are you there?
More calls here. Faith in Waupun, your turn. Hi, Faith.
Hi.
Hi, what's on your mind, Faith?
I'm wondering why I'm getting yellow leaves on my geraniums. This isn't the first year either that I've had that. It seems like about this time of the year they start getting yellow leaves.
Hmm. Diana, do you want to crack at that?
Sure. So yellowing leaves, can you tell me, is it like the lower leaves of the plant or is it all over the plant?
Well, it's usually all over the plant.
Okay. And are these in a container or are they in the ground?
No, they're in a container. But I do have some in the ground, too, that are getting it.
Okay. Okay. Usually when the leaves are getting yellow like this, it's something environmental. So usually it's either too much water, too little water, uneven watering, and that can really affect a lot of different things. We can get some root rot or some root damage in there, and then the plants aren't able to take up the water, and so then we get yellowing leaves dropping off. And geraniums are pretty notorious for doing this. I see a lot of yellow leaves on geraniums. So it's not likely an insect or a disease that you can spray something for. There might be some roots rotting down there because they've been damaged by uneven watering. And then, especially this year, when you throw in there all the stress that the weather has given us from the heat, that makes these plants more susceptible to any kind of root rot or things like that. So there's not a lot I can tell you other than to, if you're not getting rain, water, but you should only be watering like once or twice a week. You shouldn't water every day. If you're not sure if you should water or not, stick your finger down in the soil and see if it's dry a half an inch down, then it's time to water. With containers, you normally do have to water every day, especially if it's out in the full sun, which it would be if you have geraniums because they're a sun plant. But the problem with containers and why we get this problem in containers a lot is because by the end of the day, when it's 95 degrees and sunny, that whole soil ball in that container has gotten really hot from the sun hitting it and that. And it's just really stressful for the plants. So the in-ground ones, you should water less than the containers. Make sure that it's not overly waterlogged or overly moist or overly wet, but yet don't let things dry out. And otherwise, there's not a lot I can suggest. And I don't know, Kevin, if you have any other ideas.
Well, I think you touched on a lot of the challenges with growing plants in containers is that microenvironment. You've got this pot now that, it's going to heat up much quicker and it's going to dry out. So that's that whole challenge with uneven watering, too much, too little. You touched on the full sun. Nutrient deficiencies certainly can happen in pots more often than when they're in the ground. We're leaching nutrients through every time we water. So that's where that spoon feeding or slow release fertilizing, however you want to do that. Oftentimes yellowing on a lot of plants is an indication of lack of nitrogen. But in some cases, it might be a micronutrient deficiency, like maybe magnesium or something like that. So, that's where you just have to think about your fertilizing program and how often do you give them a little shot of, I like to use a water-soluble type liquid fertilizer, but you can certainly do this with, just top dressing with some organic amendments as well, too. But certainly fertilizing potted plants a couple times during the growing season is something we would suggest people do because of what I just mentioned with the leaching and stuff. And then the last possibility might be some kind of disease, a bacterial or fungal leaf spot or something like that. But I would suspect it's more of the environmental stuff that we've already talked about.
All right. Thank you so much for that question, Faith. Ron in Madison, your turn. Hi, Ron.
Thanks. Must gravel mulch be removed where it's 3 inches or deeper against a brick and mortar siding? I'm most concerned about the north walls of the buildings that are always shaded. And is it freezing and thawing that breaks out the mortar, or is mildew and black mold the main concern?
Well, what do you go ahead, Diana?
Gravel mulch drains. So the top couple inches of it, there's not standing water in there. It's only moist down at the soil level. So I don't think it's so here we're getting outside of horticulture and we're getting into construction and stuff. So we're getting outside of my ability to answer this question. But I don't think having some rock mulch up against brick is a problem because the top part of that rock mulch shouldn't be holding any actual moisture like a wood mulch might. Beyond that, you know, I think there's probably a lot of different kinds of brick and mortar and stuff that have, you know, various tolerances and stuff. And I just don't know what's going to be breaking that apart. So, I can't
comment on that part. Well, Ron, thank you for calling. Richard in Two Rivers, your turn. Hi, Richard.
Yeah, hello, Larry.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I got a, well, I have a problem. Okay, first of all, I listen to you guys too much. You told me not to till so much on one of your past shows. So I ended up putting that landscaping paper down in my garden that goes along the side of the house. And I actually sold some other guy on it because it had worked before. And he's an older guy on a fixed income. I feel really bad about it. But he ended up ripping it all up because the weeds were just growing underneath it. And now I'm seeing that too. And I don't know whether to just rip it up and start tilling around it or just leave it and see what happens when the plants get bigger.
When you
say landscape paper, is it actually a paper or are you talking about a plastic or a landscape fabric?
It's a fabric. It's, stuff you pick up at Menards or whatever. Yeah. It's the black stuff. It comes in, 28-foot rolls. Yeah,
and that's what we were talking about earlier. That stuff works for a year or two, and then it doesn't. And depending on the quality of it, you might get stuff growing underneath it. Otherwise, you get stuff growing on top of it. So it's a temporary thing. And if it were me, I would rip it up get it all weed free again, and then. Yeah. And then one of the best ways to get a nice bed going is to, if you can then put down cardboard, and cardboard is organic, just your basic brown corrugated cardboard is usually organic. Just, peel off any stickers or tape and stuff, or else you can do basic newspaper and do it about 6-7 sheets thick. And lay that down. That'll create a good barrier from seeds that are in the soil. And then top that off with the organic mulch like we've been talking about. So either shredded wood, if it's a perennial or shrub border, if it's more like a annual bed or a vegetable bed sort of thing, then you could use chopped leaves or dried grass clippings or straw, things like that, that decompose a little faster. And then you can leave that on there. It'll just all kind of become organic matter in the soil. And then each year you can just kind of plant into that without tilling it up and add another layer of weed control every year. So this is a good example of that fabric not working out in the end.
Yeah, unfortunately. Richard, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Fawn in Madison, your turn. You want to get rid of some creeping Charlie?
I sure do. I have a raised bed garden that has been completely taken over by creeping Charlie. I'm so discouraged. So I thought I would maybe smother it with black plastic first and then do that for, I don't know, 3-6 weeks. I don't know how much time I have in the season to do that. But then afterwards, I would like to use some sort of mulch. What would you recommend? Maybe the cardboard and straw that you said? I want to plant vegetables and a few herbs.
Sure. All right. Kevin?
Sure. Well, Creeping Charlie is a very common, notorious, as the name implies, creeping plant, and it spreads and it gets well established. And, you know, if you're wanting to get rid of it without a herbicide, the best thing to do is smother it. And that's going to take some time. If you're not adverse to using, you know, a black plastic type of cover, that, you know, you can solarize it, and maybe that's a little quicker. But I'm a big fan of doing it organically, and, you know, put down whatever layers you can to smother it. Might take several months before that really dies out, because, like Diana said, these rhizomes and underground plant structures, they can live a long time, and, you know, it might take more than 3 or 4 weeks to accomplish this with a smothering mulch. And then once you peel that mulch back and you see that it's, you know, indeed dead, now what do you do? I mean, if you're able to work all that back into the soil, or do you want to do lasagna gardening on top of it? There's lots of options when we go with these organic mulches, because they do break down over time. So that would be my suggestion, is to just try lasagna gardening and plant right over the top.
Vaughn, thank you so much. Kevin Chesso, Ag Development Educator for UW Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties. Diana Alfith, the Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. Don't forget about the survey, by the way. I just want to mention that. Go to WPR.org/Larry and fill out the survey question. It'll only take you a couple of minutes. Nice to have you with us for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest Diana Alfith and Kevin Chesso back with us. Diana, Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. Kevin, the Ag Development Educator for UW-Madison Division of Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties. Questions, give a call, 800-642-1234. Email us to ideas@wpr.org. Tomatoes are starting to take off right now, at least mine are. What are your thoughts on pruning them? I've heard various, I mean, some people say, yeah, prune them, and other people say, no, I don't want to lose any of those leaves that are going to help capture the sunlight. What do you think, Diana?
Yeah, so you're right. It is a little controversial. There's been some research done on it, as far as like pruning out the suckers, which are little shoots of leaves that form where like a stem and a branch or a leaf join. You'll get a little growth in between there. And the research seems to be a little mixed as well, as far as if that increases production. However, there is merit in pruning tomato plants to increase airflow. So most tomato gardeners, of course, battle blight, early blight, sometimes late blight, which are fungal diseases. And fungal diseases like wet leaves and or high humidity. So pruning out some of the lower branches, pruning out select branches, pruning out those suckers might open up the canopy of the plant a little bit better, and therefore decrease the humidity and decrease your problems with these foliar fungal diseases. So it kind of depends. If you're growing determinant tomatoes, you usually don't do any pruning, because those are the ones that they send up all their flowers and they get all their fruits kind of at once, and then the plant kind of shuts down. Those are things like the Roma tomatoes, I believe, are determinants. The indeterminate ones, which are cherry tomatoes and some of the other bigger ones, they continue to produce flowers and tomatoes all year long. So those are the ones that we're talking about that you might do some pruning on. It kind of depends on your situation. If you have your plants really spaced out well so that you're getting good air circulation, you know, it might not be as necessary, but if you have a big, thick jungle, then pruning out some of that to increase airflow is probably a good thing. Kevin, what do you think?
Yeah, no, again, you know, like I said earlier, gardening is shades of green. And, you know, again, it all depends. And if you've got the plant that really shouldn't be pruned, then you maybe don't want to get too carried away. But certainly these vining type plants, you got to kind of keep them in check and manage them. And like you said, the primary reason I like to advocate not only pruning, but the other parts that come with this topic, especially on tomatoes, is trellising, staking, caging. There's all kinds of different techniques when we're growing vertical. And tomatoes, you know, if you don't give them support, they're going to just turn, like you said, turn into a jungle and flop over. And having a good, strong, sturdy support system for that plant is another part of this discussion, because, you know, you can prune them, but they're still going to vine out. And you, what do you do with all that vertical growth? And that's where you can do this with fencing and twine and the tomato cages. And I think, Diana, you've seen this umpteen times. And I don't know why the industry is so stuck on these hoops that have the little tiny base, and then they go up, you know, with the wider circles on top, and they tip over every time, right? So you put a trowel in there, or a, you know, a wood stake to add additional support. I'm just like, you know, for smaller plants, they're fine, but if you got a big tomato, you got to have a much larger support system. So that's where we can get into the trellising technique. So, pruning is all part of that, and it's just, what are you trying to do, and what space do you have, and how much time do you want to put into managing your crop? Because if you're doing, you know, greenhouse production, you know, trellising and pruning and all that is super critical to maintaining production. But for the average person in the backyard, you know, you don't have to get so involved. But and on that note, Larry, I just wanted to go back and remind listeners that UW Extension does have a Wisconsin horticulture website. That's horticulture.extension.wisc.edu. And what I really like about this new designed topic hub, as we call it, is they populate this with various articles that are timely. And there's a bunch of cool stuff on here right now. You know, they've got rain barrels and some lawn stuff, Wisconsin bee identification. You know, bees are out now. But there's an article that's posted on this web site called Trellising, Staking, and Caging for Vertical Gardening. So that publication talks all about these different techniques. And I think they're wonderful, especially in small spaces. We can get so much more productive with these techniques when we don't have a lot of space for sprawling. So Thank you.
Good points. Yeah. And what's the, give the site again, give the website.
Yeah.
Again.
It's horticulture or no, well, hort, H-O-R-T dot extension dot wisc dot edu.
Yeah. We'll plop that on our site, wpr.org/Larry. Jill will have that up on the site. And if you didn't get it written down, you can go to WPR.org/Larry. Today's date, we'll have it up on Proto, if not already. We may already have it up there. Good points. Anne in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Anne.
Hi, how is everybody doing?
Great, thank you. What's good on your mind?
I have a chain link fence around my house, or around my yard, and my neighbor has a raspberry plant growing on her side of the fence, and on the other side, I have a perennial bed. So, of course, her raspberry plants decide that they want to live in my perennial bed, and unfortunately, she does not want to get rid of the raspberry plant, and I don't want to start a big war. So I was wondering if I could put any kind of edging between the two beds to keep her nasty little raspberry plants out. I don't really know how deep those roots go.
Yeah, you can certainly edge it, Diana.
Yeah, and it's kind of like the snow on the mountain that we were talking about earlier. Raspberries do spread by underground roots, and they grow outward. And if you don't like raspberries on your ice cream or morning cereal, because obviously you could pick those raspberries that are on your side, you can prune anything that pops up in your bed away and then put edging right at the chain link fence, right at the base of it. And again, make sure that you use the deepest stuff you can find, the 5 to 6 inch deep sort of thing, that'll stop most of those roots from creeping over onto your side. There may still be the occasional one that shoots underneath or works its way around some way or another, but that should stop most of it.
Okay.
All right. There you go.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Ann. Bruce in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Bruce.
Good afternoon. Tomato plants. Been growing them for several years. This year, I've got 3 out of 6 that they started very nicely. The leaves are perfect. And about 2 feet off the ground, the leaves are rolling up into a tight ball that's hard. And it's all the leaves above that 2-foot line. Help me out.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah. Kevin? We're seeing a lot of that this year, Kevin, right?
Yeah, you know, and every year is different. And, you know, I would suspect environmental, but, you know, again, we have to put on our CSI horticulture hat again and think about, you know, what might be going on in that environment that causes that. And, you know, if there's some unique pattern that, you know, you can associate with some environmental conditions, or is it more, you know, there's biotic diseases or biotic conditions that are caused by an organism. And then there's abiotic, which are the, you know, non-living, you know, like herbicide drift, like drought tolerance, nutrient deficiencies. You know, there are things that can cause distorted growth. Sometimes it's a virus or a virus-like organism. You know, so I guess you'd have to think about that some more. And I, without asking you more questions, is there something that you think may have caused that, or is it just kind of out of the blue?
Let me give you some characteristics. These are all Home Depot bought plants that I've used for a couple of years. 2 are in bag containers that I heard about on this show. One of them is planted into new ground. And another one is in a pot that I've used for tomatoes for forever. So environmentally, I can't think of anything. I live in the city. We don't have any gardens or anything in the vicinity.
So did you the first thing when we see curling leaves, we think of, as Kevin mentioned, herbicide drift. Have you sprayed your lawn for dandelions at all?
No. And these are not just curling. These are rolling up into a tight ball. I mean, it's the size of a pencil eraser.
Sure. So the first thing to do, sometimes, like Kevin said, sometimes we can get viruses that might cause these. Sometimes there can be some insects. So if you break that ball open, just look for any kind of little things running around. Sometimes there are some mites.
I've done that. Okay. There's nothing inside the balls.
Okay. So then I'm going to blame it on heat. Because we're actually seeing a lot of curled tomato leaves across the state this year. On some of the Facebook gardening groups, people are posting it like crazy. I've gotten lots of calls about it. And we know that tomatoes are heat-loving plants, but once it gets above like 86 degrees, it's too hot for them as well. They start shutting down. They'll abort flowers. And even though you have plenty of water on there, they can't take up enough to counteract what's being lost. And the new foliage, as it's growing, it can be damaged by that heat. And then we can get this distortion and stuff. So it's probably heat and environment kind of a thing going on. And hopefully it will outgrow it. But chances are there's not much you can do about it. Now, if we suspect a virus, usually viruses can also cause some discoloration on some leaves, like some weird patterns, yellowing, mottling, that sort of a thing. If you see any kind of that sort of thing on other leaves, then it might be worth sending a sample down to our disease diagnostics clinic and testing for a virus. There's nothing you can do to cure a virus. If a plant has a virus, you can't get rid of it. It just will always have it. But I'm really suspecting in this case that it's the heat that has damaged those.
There you go, Bruce. Not much we can do about that. But, you know, leave them in and see what happens, I guess. That's about all you can do at this point.
Thank you.
Oh, man. Dave in Broadhead, your turn. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Larry. Hey, I've got a question. I've got two eastern red cedars in my backyard that are, they're probably 25 feet tall and probably 20 feet in diameter. And I don't trim the lower branches off because I know they like to have their roots shaded and stuff, but I get all kinds of weed growth underneath them. And I try and get under there with my weed eater and keep all the stuff down, but it's practically impossible. And the problem I'm not sure about is what kind of mulch I should use if I put a mulch under there that the weeds won't grow in, and or that that seeds that birds that nest in the trees drop on the mulch. If, you know, I don't want them to just germinate and grow through the mulch. I'm just curious as to what would be the best way to mulch those things.
Yeah, and I'd go back to, I would weed whack it down as much as you can, put down a nice thick layer of cardboard, throw some shredded wood mulch on top of that about 4 inches deep. That'll basically smother out anything that's currently there. But nature has its way of spreading plants, and those birds are going to continue to nest in there and poop out seeds, and they will land on that mulch and they will occasionally germinate. And like I said earlier, they're easier to pull out of light, fluffy mulch than they are out of soil, but it, nature will fill in that void with weeds. There's just no way around it. So every year or two, you're going to have to do a little bit of weeding out of there, and then maybe top dressing that mulch so that it cuts down on it. But there's just no other way around it.
Okay. Well, another question I have with the cardboard mulch is water going to penetrate that good enough, or do you need to poke holes in it or something like that to get the water to go through it?
Maybe you could poke a couple holes, but just water it well first before you put it down. And that cardboard, as you know, if you leave a cardboard box out in the rain, it gets all soggy and slimy. That cardboard will decompose and break down, you know, probably within a month, enough to where things are going to run through it just fine. So you might leave a few gaps between the cardboard here and there, but it's not really a major issue.
No, not really. And actually, when you lay it down, then water it good right when you lay it down, and there you go. You're in good shape. Dave, thanks. Kenneth in Janesville, hi.
Hello. I've got a couple of climbing roses, but I cut them back every year down to the ground because they're perennial and they look more like bushes. But the question is that one bush on the left is brooming profusely. It's continued to bloom profusely, but the one on the right about 2 years ago stopped blooming completely, growing twice as good as the one on the left, you know, in bush and so forth, but not a bloom to be found.
Well, that's interesting. How far apart are they?
About 3 feet.
Oh, so right next to each other, pretty much.
Well, whenever we don't see blossoms, I guess I think of, you know, sometimes the obvious as well is a deer nibbling on that plant and not the other. I'm not suggesting that's the case here, but, you know, what causes, you know, one plant to bloom and one not? So that just something to think about. You know, the other, I guess, you know, thing to consider is, you know, is there some environmental changes between the two plants? You know, fertility, sunlight, too much for
fertility. Could be a rock underground. Could be a rock underground that the roots finally hit.
Well, yeah, there's something that plant is not initiating flower buds. And Diana, you know how, you know, plant hormones work, and, you know, we can see differences just because of soil conditions. Like you said, too much nitrogen can sometimes cause flowers to or plants not to set so many flowers, you know. So I don't know if you have anything you want to add.
Well, one of the things, we don't know the variety of this, but a lot of our climbing roses, of course, they're a cultivar, and a lot of roses are grafted. So they're grafted onto a root system. So my concern is that maybe that one that's not blooming anymore, actually the top died off, and what grew up was the rootstock, so that it's actually a different variety. And rootstocks are usually, you know, they're grown to be rootstocks, so they may not bloom like the variety that you actually bought and planted there originally. And so when you cut it down every year, that one might be one that blooms on old wood, and so you never get to the bloom. So I would look really closely, like, at the leaves to see if the leaves look any different, or, you know, something like that. Usually if it doesn't bloom, it's because the rootstock grew up, or one of them is now in the shade because trees grew up and now it's in the shade. But if they're only 3 feet away, that's probably not likely. But I'm just wondering if you actually still have two identical roses.
That is a good point.
I wondered if I cut it back to the one on the right that's not blooming. A couple of years ago, I think I cut it back too short.
That might have encouraged the rootstock to send up shoots, and then you lost the actual variety that you planted there. So that's my suspicion in this case.
Yeah, that'd be one where you might want to just dig that one up, Diana, and put a new one in there and see what happens. I think you've got to hit the nail on the head.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Liz emailed to suggest using hostas around trees. We were talking about mulch. They fill out and suppress weeds and protect the trunk from mowing too close. They also look nice. So she suggested that. Now, they will compete a little bit for water.
Yeah, usually not too much, though. A hosta's roots are not that extensive, and tree roots grow outward. Okay, so the majority of a tree's roots are in the top 8 to 15 inches of the soil, and they'll grow out away from the trunk 2 to 3 times the height of that tree. So most of the really important roots of the tree are out at the canopy or beyond. And so the right around the base probably aren't going to hurt anything. But just be cautious, because usually you still want to put some mulch in between those hostas so that you don't get weed growth and stuff. So make sure, again, that it's not up against the trunk of the tree, and that it's more like the donut and not the volcano, like we talked about earlier.
On that note, we are out of time. Kevin and Diana, thank you both very much for being with us today. It flew by. And just a reminder, we're partnering with the UW-Madison's Extension Horticulture Program to learn more about your experience listening to the show, to Garden Talk, maybe to also give us some ideas for future shows. So if you go to WPR.org/Larry, and click on today's show, WPR.org/Larry. Click on today's show for a show note for a link, or you can type in gowisc.edu/radio on any browser. It'll just take a couple of minutes to fill it all out. Diana Alfeth, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. Kevin Gesso works out of Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties, where he's the Ag Development Educator for Extension. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network.